This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is an historic moment. According to our guest, a minor historic moment. We have the man who is the premier film critic and historian and interviewer of the A-plus list. Our guest today has interviewed here at the Santa Barbara Film Festival and in other places Robert Redford, Will Smith, Martin Scorsese, Clint Eastwood, James Cameron, Kate Blanchett, Sean Penn, Anthony Hopkins. But today, for the first time in history, we are turning the tables and interviewing Leonard Maltin. Please welcome our guest, Leonard Maltin.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For those of you who have been living in a cave since 1917, this man has so many books on the New York Times bestseller list because every year since 1969, or every couple of years since 1969, we get a new one of these. Do we know this book, ladies and gentlemen? This is our Bible. This book and the accompanying app tell us everything we need to know about every movie we need about which we need to know it. Did I parse that sentence correctly?
No.
Okay.
But you tried, and that's what really matters.
Speaking of no, you hold the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yes. I'm in the Guinness Book for having written the shortest movie review in history. It's for a 1948 film called Isn't It Romantic? And the review is no. And I didn't do it as a stunt. I did it as a joke, but not as a stunt. And somebody submitted it to the Guinness Book, and they printed it.
And you could hardly write a shorter review unless it was
I guess.
So let me tell you a little bit about Leonard. Leonard is, as I said, a New York Times bestseller. If you go to Amazon and look for the Leonard Maltin book page, you will find three pages of Leonard Maltin book page.
Does that have meaning to anybody anymore? When I was growing up, the idea of getting a book published was like a mountain. It was like scaling Everest.
With your picture on the
front of it. I know. That came later.
All of them. I know.
But it was like scaling Everest to me as an aspiring writer. And now, people have gone virtual. And everything is online, including information, especially information, and which is why fewer and fewer people buy a reference book, because they figure, well, you can get all that for free online. Now that you can get online, you can get it for free without paying for it. So that's a sea change. And the other change is that everyone can self-publish books now. So just as anybody can go on YouTube and call themselves a filmmaker, you can call yourself a songwriter. You can call yourself an artist, a singer, anything you want. And, of course, you can be a blogger, so anybody can be a film critic. No entrance exam required. So we live in an age of self-empowerment and, I may say with some prejudice, self-delusion. But, again, somebody handed me a book 2 weeks ago. I was at an event, and a guy handed me a book he had written. It was a professional-looking hardcover book with a great-looking dust jacket, perfectly bound, in every way, an utterly professional hardcover book, except he published it himself. And on the one hand, we're supposed to applaud the democratization of the media communications. And I do. The artist in me, the creator in me, does applaud that. No longer are there gatekeepers saying, no, you're not good enough to be published. No, you're not good enough to have your song, released to the world. No, your film isn't good enough to show at a festival. Now anybody can just do it. That part is great. The self-delusion part comes in thinking that the world is waiting for it, or that anybody's going to pay attention to what you do. Now, there are a lot of talented people out there. This is not a secret. There's a lot of really talented people out there who perhaps couldn't have gotten past the gatekeepers before just because It's hard to break into anything, you know, and that's always been true. But what we've lost in the process is that moment that I experienced and you experienced in your career when somebody said, you're good enough to be a professional. You're good enough to be paid for what you do. That's how good you are. That's a rite of passage. And it's the beginning of a career. And so something's been lost, even though something else has been gained.
I want to come back to that to talk about you guys and how this applies to you. But while we're at that moment, I want to talk about when that moment came for you. That moment of being told, you're a professional. You deserve to be paid.
Well, it came in stages. When I was in the fifth grade, a friend and I decided we wanted to print our own newspaper. Not a full-blown newspaper, but it was really more like a newsletter, I guess you call it, a newsletter. And I won't bore you with the low technology of the time.
Oh, please.
Because it was really low. Our first issue had three copies, a circulation of three, because we had an original and two carbon copies. And everything I say has to be explained now. Do you know what carbon paper is?
Do you guys know what carbon paper is?
Not everybody does. But, you know, it was how we used to make copies. If you put three pages of paper with two carbon papers in between them into a typewriters, and you scrolled up and then you typed on it, or you could draw on it with a ballpoint pen.
Press hard.
You could wind up with an original and two sort of facsimile copies. And so that's what we did initially. And then we learned that there was something called a hectograph. Pay attention and then forget this, because you'll never need to know this the rest of your life.
Unless you make a period piece.
Yes, that's true. Well, even then you wouldn't. This is really arcane. We had no money, and we wanted to print copies. And someone said, well, you can get a hectograph at the office supply store. What's that? Well, it's about a 9x12, very thin, like maybe a half an inch thick, vat of hard gelatin. Try to picture this. And you could take what was then called the Ditto stencil. This is boring.
No. This is cool. Because where else are they going to
hear
this?
There were mimeograph
machines.
In the days before xerography and photocopying, there were days before xerography and photocopying. And before there were Kinko's and, you know, FedEx stores on the corner and all of that
stuff. Now I just snap a picture with my iPhone and email it.
That's right. It's so different. It's so stupendously different. We were living in the Cro-Magnon era then, though. And so you used a mimeograph machine, which used a stencil with ink and a drum, and you'd turn this drum, and it would feed pages in, and you could make copies that way. We couldn't afford one of those machines. But if you got a stencil and then took this vat of gelatin, which cost $3, and you took a sponge and dampened the sponge, and dampened down the vat of gelatin, and then took this Ditto stencil and pressed it onto the gelatin and rubbed it down real hard and then peeled it up, it left an impression in the gelatin, whatever you had typed or drawn. And then you would take slightly coated paper, you'd buy a ream of paper at the office supply store, and you could put that piece of paper down and rub it and peel it up, and you had a copy. And I think hecto, any Latin students, I think that means 50. It's the prefix for 50. Don't all shout at once.
Latin.
supposed to do 50 copies. We called it the 30-ograph, because about copy 30, it started getting blurry. But we would get 30 copies of our little newsletter that way.
And were you selling it?
Let's see. Were we selling it? I don't remember. We eventually did. At first, we just wanted to circulate it among our schoolmates, you know, for people to read.
Okay. One of the emerging topics that we find happens in this class a lot is it's kind of a Tom Sawyer thing,
mm-hmm.
where you go, you start something, and one day that is the thing you do for actual money.
Yes, and in fact, what happened was Google came and bought us out for $1 billion.
Uh-huh.
That's actually what happened out of the hectograph. You may not have read that online, but it's true.
I actually think at some point one of my filmmakers here. Maybe doing a period piece. And a hectograph is kind of a little known but very cool fact.
Very little known. Anyway, We then inherited a mimeograph machine, which was a little better, and we could make more copies that way. And we did start selling it eventually. And then I found out, I was reading a magazine that all kids of my age used to read, a newsstand magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland, which charted the great horror movies, which were then on television. And if you want to learn about the original Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy and the Wolfman, you bought this magazine. And a lot of us did. Stephen King adored this magazine. Steven Spielberg doted on this magazine. A whole generation of baby boomers grew up on this magazine. The guy with the white hair over there grew up on this magazine.
I know him.
And they did a story, one issue, about fanzines. Fanzines were amateur magazines. And so we decided instead of a newsletter, we wanted to make it more of a magazine, what we were doing. But then I wrote to two of the magazines listed in this little article and offered my services as a writer, not telling them I was 13 years old.
Oh, okay, you're not in the fifth grade anymore.
No.
It's a couple years later.
We've jumped ahead.
Okay.
Well, we only have 4 hours, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So, and both, I think I may have submitted a sample article to each of them, and they both said, this is good. We'd like to print it. Now, there was no money involved then. Because this was just labor of love type of stuff. The guy who printed the magazine in Indiana, Pennsylvania, was a furniture dealer. And he did this magazine because he loved silent movies and wanted to have a place to write about them and talk about them. And the other fellow, who it turned out was 19 years old, was in Vancouver, Canada. And he published a magazine called Film Fan Monthly. And again, it was for film collectors. People used to collect films on 8mm and 16mm film, sprocket holes. It's another dead medium. But anyway, they both said yes. And when they said yes, I then told them I was 13 years old, and they both wrote back and said, we don't care. We like your articles. So that's when I first saw my name in print in something that I didn't publish. And that was a milestone, seeing my first bylines. Very exciting. Very, very exciting. I think the first time I got paid and saw my byline, I was 18, and I had an article in Esquire magazine.
Ooh.
And that was pretty exciting.
That's a big move.
Yeah, it was.
What was the article on?
I never bought a second one, but they did buy that one. The 50 best movies to watch on TV.
Okay. So very, very, very early, these things that are going to become your life, your life's work, are emerging. The movie, the monster movies, the 50 best movies to watch on TV. You're already starting to not only analyze movies but or talk about them, but collect them.
Well, yeah, and it was film history that really hooked me. When I was growing up, I was a child of the first television generation. And in those days, 50s and 60s, TV was a living museum of movies. Nowadays, if you want to see an old movie, you have to go to Turner Classic Movies on TV. And sometimes Fox Movie Channel will show something old. Every now and then PBS will show something old. But in those days, before cable television, before pay TV, before the 200-channel universe, in those days, I lived in the suburbs of New York City. And we had more stations than some cities did. But we had 7 stations around the dial. And they had to fill up all this airtime. And it was before somebody had thought of infomercials. So what they filled the airtime with was old movies. They were inescapable. So you didn't have to be a film buff to see old movies. You didn't have to seek them out. They were everywhere. They were ubiquitous. They were inescapable. And every day I would watch Laurel and Hardy, because they showed those for kids in the mornings and the afternoons. I would watch Laurel and Hardy. I would watch The Little Rascals. I would watch The Three Stooges. And I would watch tons and tons of old cartoons.
So
not knowing they were old, I just loved them. And the other huge influence was watching Walt Disney. Every week, Walt Disney hosted an enormously popular weekly television show. And
Wonderful World of Color.
At first it was called Disneyland.
Oh, okay.
Then it was called Walt Disney Presents, and finally it was called Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. And I felt, as did millions of other people, a real connection to him because he was very affable and kind of like an uncle, kind of like a friendly uncle. Who would talk about? He would talk about his history. He would talk about how they made the first feature-length cartoon, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. and show you behind-the-scenes footage. He would promote his upcoming movies, too, and he did original programming for the show as well. And at the same time, he launched, on weekdays, the Mickey Mouse Club, which was just a sensation. And you have to try to picture this, that in those days there were only three television networks. Three.
Period. Just three
ABC,
choices.
CBS, NBC. That was all there was. And then some local stations in whatever city you happen to live in. So the audience was divided into bigger chunks. Today the audience is fragmented. But in those days, you got like a Super Bowl-sized audience every week mm-hmm. watching Walt Disney.
And talking about it on Monday
morning. Oh, yes,
morning.
And the next morning at school or wherever you happen to be. Yeah.
You had to be in front of the TV then.
Yeah.
So that you wouldn't be out the next morning.
That's right.
Yep.
It was a big deal. So all those things I saw as a kid had an enormous influence on me and piqued my curiosity. I wanted to know more about them. You know, who were Laurel and Hardy? When were these films? And then my parents threw me a curve. They said, well, you know, we used to watch them when we were growing up. That's a very difficult concept for a child to grasp. What do you mean? You know, well, yeah, they're not new. They're old. And, you know, they've been around for a long time. Tough concept, but I started to get interested in that.
The idea that something had lived.
Right. What's the history? What's the story behind it? And I was a precocious reader. I went to my local library and I would seek out any book they had about all of this history. And there weren't many books to read then. And I wound up writing some of the books that I wanted to read.
Did you become the change you wished to see in the film world?
Oh, that's good.
What's
never
Gandhi,
heard that one.
But...
Well, Gandhi. You're going to show off and quote Gandhi. Yeah, that's what happened. I wound up writing a book about Walt Disney's films.
You wrote about Walt Disney. You wrote about The Little Rascals. Yep. How many books have you written?
It's either 11 or 12.
No.
Yeah.
Amazon tells me many, many, many more.
Well, I edited more than
that. Oh, edited. Okay, yeah. So total, how many books have your name on them?
Lots.
30?
Several dozen.
70? Mm-hmm. I'm just making up numbers here. Lots. Three pages.
But I actually wrote cover to cover, I think, either 11 or 12 books.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
When you sit down, do you have a favorite child among your books?
No. Like parents who are asked for a favorite child, I can't tell you that.
Then let's just pick a random child.
I brought one.
Okay.
I brought one because this is still actually in existence. It's still in print after 34 years. This is a history of animated cartoons that I wrote called Of Mice and Magic. And the only reason it's still in print is that some courses have adopted it.
Oh, nice.
Some college courses on animation. But there had never been a book like this. And I was the first one to write it. There have been several since.
There had never been a book in what way?
Okay, I used to watch every day old Warner Brothers cartoons on TV.
Dave, let's put this up there too.
Porky Pig, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, you know, Elmer Fudd, all those characters. And I guess I just had an innate curiosity about all these things, and I always wanted to know about them. Who are those names that keep turning up on the credits? Why does Porky look different in this cartoon than he does in that cartoon? Why does Daffy act different in this cartoon than he does in that cartoon? And there are answers to all those things. But they were not obtainable then. And bit by bit, slowly, over the many, many years' time, I started intuiting some of the answers, guessing at some of the answers, quite honestly, and trying to write about, trying to find a continuum in order to be able to write about them. And many other cartoon studios, too. I used to watch the Max Fleischer cartoons. He introduced Betty Boop and Popeye and other characters. So I was a sponge soaking all this up. The way some people are with sports, you know, where they just soak up everything there is to know about baseball or football or basketball. That's how I was with all of this. And eventually, I guess it was in the 70s, some other animation buffs and scholars started tracking down some of the people and publishing some articles, and that helped open some doors for me to understand who was who and how all this happened. And then I decided I was going to try to write a history of American animated cartoons of that studio period. And I wound up interviewing dozens and dozens of these guys who made all those cartoons I'd watched since I was 3 years old. I mean, I sat with Walter Lantz, who started making animated cartoons in 1916. He was there. He was in on like the, virtually the birth of animation. I talked to a guy named Al Eugster, who wound up animating for several studios, but his first job in the silent film era was inking in Felix the Cat. You know, just, you know, I it's like touching history. Somebody said, you know, shake the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand that shook the hand of Napoleon. That's how you connect to history. And I connected to this history because I was so lucky. My timing was so good. I happened to be around at a time when so many of these people were still alive. I missed out on meeting Max Fleischer. I missed out on meeting Walt Disney. But I got to know an awful lot of people who worked for them, who worked closely with them.
Who shook their hands.
Yeah.
You had this curiosity that drove you to need to answer these questions for yourself. And then you put them into a volume that answers them for us, that answers them now. How many printings did you say this has had?
I don't know.
Over this many years, 40 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's a very interesting thing, that the book then keeps going on and going on and exists to answer those questions. But at the beginning, you just started out by asking them, by asking these questions for yourself to satisfy your own curiosity.
Yeah, sure, sure. And actually, I started teaching a course in New York at the New School for Social Research, in the 70s, on the history of animation. And I found that the greatest benefit of teaching that course was that it forced me to think through all of this. It forced me to organize my thoughts and articulate my feelings about these various cartoons and the different studios and their approach to animation.
Had you gained access to somebody like, let's say, Walter Lantz, by virtue of your station, you know, as a film critic?
No.
Did you just cold call?
I was some guy.
Okay.
In the case of Walter Lantz, I worked on and off at the film department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And they did a tribute to him one day, and he flew in from California for this tribute, and I used my connections at the museum to get to meet with him. And I had a book that I'd gotten when I was 7 or 8 years old called Walter Lantz's Easy, I think it's E-Z, Easy Way to Draw.
I remember.
With Woody Woodpecker on the cover. And he used to host his own TV show in sort of imitation of Walt Disney, and he used to do really great segments of how they made animated cartoons. They were actually more bare-bones informational than Disney's were. Disney sort of dressed them up a bit. But Walter Lantz's, they would show you what an exposure sheet was and how animators, you know, timed lip movement and dialogue, you know, and how they made everything come together. And he signed my copy of that book with a little Woody Woodpecker head, you know. And so then, having met him, we had a brief conversation that day. But I got his studio phone number and then ran up a long-distance bill in those days, talking to him, you know, on the phone and doing a proper interview.
I think what would be really valuable for us, especially as, you know, these guys go out into the world, is how do you approach somebody like that that you admire and would like to learn more about?
Well, I used to write a lot of letters. I started writing letters when I was 12 or 13. And you know, it's such a different world today because of electronic communication, because of email. I don't know how you, I'm not sure how you stand out, but I know this, I will always go out of my way to answer an interesting and well-written letter, email, snail mail, whatever it may be. And, you know, just as in a job interview, first impression counts so much, it's true here too. You have to present yourself a certain way. You have to get across the fact that you are serious, you're enthusiastic, you're really interested, and it would mean a lot if they would grant you an interview or give you a little time, you know, to answer some questions. Again, when I was doing it, I think it was a little easier because in the sense that it was harder to reach these people. Now everybody's got an email address of some sort, you know. It was more of a challenge to find these people. And so finding them was an accomplishment in itself. And some of them were not accustomed to being approached. So it was, you know, it was more of an event for them. I say, oh, this kid's interested. Okay. I wrote a fan letter to Charles M. Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. Because I wanted to be a cartoonist when I was very young. And I sent him some of my sample cartoons. He wrote back the nicest personal letter on Peanut stationery with Charlie Brown and Snoopy printed on it. I mean, it was a genuinely kind and encouraging letter. And he included in the package an original pen and ink daily wow. Peanut strip, which I had not even thought or dared to ask for. And that was overwhelming. 30 years later, I got hired to interview him on video at his studio in Santa Rosa for a touring museum show that was going to travel the country on Peanuts, I think, 35th anniversary, something like that. And as I sat down with him in his studio, I said, now, you have no way of knowing this, but I wrote you a letter when I was 13 years old, and you were so kind, and it meant a great deal to me, and you sent me an original daily strip, which, of course, I have framed on my wall. And he jumped up out of his chair. He said, whoa, we've got to get something newer than that. And he went and rifled through Sunday pages and found a Sunday page and signed it to my wife and me. And this time he signed it Sparky, because that was his nickname to people who knew him. I mean, you know, sometimes you just have to get lucky.
Yeah.
You know, luck plays a big role in all of this. But yes, I mean, writing a good letter, you know, presenting yourself well, I don't think that ever goes out of date.
But I like what you said, expressing genuine interest mm-hmm. and enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And
now, what I'm not good at is I'm not good at making the second approach if somebody turns me down. And I find that most stories I read and most people I talk to will talk about having doors slammed in their face or getting no answer at all and then going back and being persistent. I've been on the receiving end of that when people are after me sometimes for an interview or to appear in their documentary or something. And there's a very fine line between being persistent and being obnoxious. And some people know how to walk that line and never tilt over to the negative side. And the people who are articulate and enthusiastic and persistent sometimes get my attention. So I wish I'd taken a page from their playbook
yeah.
years ago.
I wish we knew where that line was.
Yeah.
How to just go right up to the edge of obnoxious, but not tilt over.
Well, there was I heard from a parent a few years ago who was pushing, there's no other way to say it, pushing his 9 or 10 year old son, who was a precocious film critic. And wanted to meet me and all this. And I found that I was turned off by it because I really wanted to hear from the boy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to hear from the bragging father. I wanted to hear from that 10-year-old, or 9-year-old. And I would have responded in a whole different way. I forget what I did. I was polite, but, you know, it didn't hit me in that sweet spot.
It felt something like that feels a little like, are the parents being exploiting
yes, exactly, the kid a exactly,
exactly. I mean, as an 8-year-old, you were making your own Hectors.
Yeah.
But so you're looking for that kid.
Yeah.
Or that person.
Yeah.
Who, where there's a direct connection.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. But I had great good fortune, you know, trying to approach a lot of people. Sometimes it didn't work. Some people I wrote to never heard back. It was always disappointing. These are the days of what we now call snail mail. And, I mean, I waited for that daily mail delivery, hoping that I would be getting answers to the letters I'd sent out. And sometimes I did, and sometimes I didn't.
But you keep sending them.
I kept trying.
Yeah, you keep I kept sending out new letters.
Right. And then I got lucky, too, when I was working on the animation book and on several subsequent books, where once you get through to one person, if they're responsive to you, they can open the door to another person.
Ride that wave.
And that makes a difference also. And I was very lucky that way.
But one of the things I'm really interested in, and I really want to just emphasize, is that you weren't afraid to ask, to make that first...
I can't believe how much nerve I had. I'm
not
kidding.
We talked about that last week. Chutzpah.
Yeah. I marvel at my own chutzpah. A friend, I wrote a letter to a fellow who was kind of a hero of mine. He was a film historian and teacher in New York City named William K. Everson. A great man, an incredibly generous man, generous with his time, generous with his access to films. He taught at NYU for many, many years, many students.
And he was your professor
prize.
There?
No.
Okay, we're going to come back to NYU.
No, he was but he was kind of a mentor. He didn't know it, but he was. And when he passed away a decade ago, his widow went through all his old correspondence and found a letter that I had written to him when I was 13 or 14 or 15 years old. And she sent it to me. God, what an awful experience. I was so embarrassed by this letter, rereading it all these years later. How did I have the... I said, I just saw Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, or something. I must say I found it rather boring. Did I have to say that? Was that really
just
an imperative?
Just up to the edge of obnoxious.
No, that leaps over the fence. That's really bad. But I had confidence, I guess. I had confidence. And I met so many nice people. I had so many really great experiences with people. Cold call, as they used to say, experiences with people. And so few sour experiences that the few I had kind of came as a shock. You mean everybody isn't nice? It was amazing, just amazing.
There's an element.
Can I tell you one? There's a great letter that I've never forgotten. I was publishing, so eventually I published, I inherited Film Fan Monthly from the guy in Canada.
Wait, your first Film Fan Monthly, that became yours?
Yeah. Well, when I was 13, I wrote to him. I volunteered an article. He said, this is great. And I started contributing a column every month, sending it to him in Vancouver. And after doing that for 2 years, he wrote to me. I never got to meet him. He wrote to me and said, in New Jersey, and said, I'm out in the real world now making a living, and I just don't have time to devote to this magazine anymore, but I hate to see it go under. I've put too much love and time and effort into it. Would you want to take it over? I was 15 at this point. And I was still doing my fanzine, which was mimeographed. Terrible invention. You don't want to go back and revisit it. Still have ink stains under my fingernails from it. He was professionally printed. Big deal. And he had 400 subscribers.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
He had 400 subscribers, mostly in the U.S. and Canada, but in Australia, New Zealand, other countries. And he said, I figure that a fair purchase price, we have $400 in the treasury. I figure a fair purchase price would be $225. So I'm going to send you $175. So I purchased the magazine by him sending me $175. Which, of course, would deal with unfulfilled, issues on subscriptions and things like that. And I was in the 10th grade. I inherited or bought, literally bought, but I look at it as inherited this magazine, which I then edited and published for the next 9 years, every month.
And you had a subscription base.
Yes, and which we expanded. We would get plugs sometimes. Variety, the show business trade magazine, wrote us up a couple times. That brought in some subscriptions, and then we advertised to classifieds and other fanzines and built up a readership. And when I say I edited and published, I also stuffed envelopes, licked stamps.
Dropped in the mailbox.
Dropped in the mail, took them to the post office, all of that. A friend was my partner at first, did all the business end of it, took care of keeping track of subscriptions and things. Then when he went off to college, my dad took over that. And he enjoyed doing it. So my father became my sort of business partner in the magazine for a while. And why did I bring this up? There was a reason. So in 1966, 67, Charlie Chaplin made his first film in years called A Countess from Hong Kong. It's now forgotten because it was a terrible film. And it turned out to be his final film. But this film starred Marlon Brando and Sophia Loren. And while it was shooting in London, it was a media magnet. You know, every magazine, Life magazine, which used to be the biggest circulation magazine in the world, went to the set and did photos there. And, you know, a lot of coverage of Chaplin making a movie again with these two big stars.
Be like, let's say, what would a present day equivalent of that be? God, can we name one?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, well, there's nobody of his stature who's international stature who's been out of the limelight,
right,
you know, for a long time.
To come back. This comeback was mega.
This is a big deal. Big deal with two big movie stars.
Right.
So Universal Pictures was financing the movie. So I wrote a letter on my little, you know, two-bit letterhead for Film Fan Monthly to the publicity director at Universal Pictures in New York City, and asked if it would be possible to get a photo or two that we could run in the magazine to talk about this upcoming film of Chaplin's. And the publicity director, whose name I blanked on, I used to carry it around like a stone in my head, wrote me the letter that said something like this. Received your letter and examined the copies of the magazine that you sent. We do not feel it is an appropriate vehicle of publicity for Universal Pictures. However, so that your letter shouldn't be a total loss, here are two photos from A Countess from Hong Kong. If he's going to send the photos anyway, why write a nasty letter? If it was a screw you letter, okay. No, we're not going to give you any photos. Goodbye. But he's sending the pictures. Why go out of your way to write something unkind to someone? I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten.
No, that has to do with his parenting. I'm pretty sure.
But, I mean, it stands
Mommy
out, too.
Mommy says yes, Daddy says no,
that's
or
right.
Vice versa.
It also stands out because it was so rare. I mean, almost everybody I approached was generous and helpful.
Is it still that way? If you make the right approach, are people willing to help?
If you approach the right person.
Who is the right person?
You don't know that ahead of time.
So
no, you don't know that. It's like throwing a dart.
Okay.
At a telephone directory. You just don't know. There are people. I found that at every studio, at every production company that I ever approached, it turned out, you didn't know this going in, there was usually one person who was there who really loved what they did, where it was not just a job. They really loved what they did. I still know people like this. And they care, they love it, they love talking about it. It's a calling as much as a profession to them. And if you're lucky enough to find that person...
That's interesting. That's a piece of insight we have not heard yet.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to find that person, then... You've hit pay dirt. And,
okay.
And I found over the years a handful of people like that and was very fortunate to connect with them.
All right, note to self. Find the people who love what they do.
Yeah.
And love it with them.
Mm-hmm.
Approach them with that same kind of...
Yeah, sure.
Genuine.
Yes.
Affection.
Yes.
Good.
I'm about to graduate from high school. I'm 17 in Teaneck, New Jersey. And... A teacher in my school, an English teacher in my school, who I didn't have for classes, but who knew me, stopped me in the hall one day and said, she'd seen the magazine, Film Fan Monthly. She said, I have a friend who's an editor at Signet Books in New York, and I just think the two of you would hit it off. I'd love you to meet him. Call him up, make an appointment after school one day, go into the city and meet him. Sure, why not? So I did. I didn't know what this might lead to, but of course, in my head, you know, dreams of maybe writing a book, you know, that something like that would come out of this meeting. I went to see him, and I brought some copies of the magazine with me. And we're breaking the ice in his office. He was a very nice man. And he said, "What's that?" I said, "I brought some copies of this magazine I edit and publish." He said, "Oh, I love your magazine." I said, "How'd you know the magazine?" He said, "Oh, I used to subscribe when I was at Popular Library," which I didn't put together. And he said, "Do you know this book that's out there called Movies on TV?" I said, "Sure, I use it every day." It was the only book of its kind. It was a paperback book with little capsule reviews of movies. And this was, again, at a time when every local TV station filled their day and night with movies. And there were people who used to just stay home and watch movies all the time, or stay up all night, insomniacs, and watch movies all the time. And that's who the book was meant for. He said, "So you know the book?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you like it?" I said, "I like it as far as it goes." He said, "Well, what would you do differently?" I didn't know where this was leading. He said, "What would you do differently?" And I started rattling off answers because I'd memorized this book. I said, "Well, I'd give more cast names." He only gives like two names, two actors per movie. I'd want more names than that. And he doesn't list the director. I'd list the director. And I'd say whether the movie was in color or black and white, which used to count more back then when they still made black and white movies. And the running time, because in those days, a lot of the local TV stations used to chop the hell out of these movies. They would try to make a two-hour movie fit in an hour-and-a-half time slot. It was murderously cruel. I said all this stuff. He said, "Well, how'd you like to do it?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm looking for somebody to do a rival book. You want to do it?" I'm 17 years old. And this came out of the blue. I swear to you, this is absolutely true. This is exactly what happened. He used to tell the story differently in later years, but I'm telling you the truth. And he was a great storyteller, but he embellished. And I said, "Well, I guess so." And within days, they were drawing up a contract, but he didn't want to tell his bosses at New American Library, which owns Sigmund Books, that he was hiring us, that he was entrusting a 17-year-old kid with this big project. So the contract was written to Film Fan Monthly so that my father didn't have to countersign. I was a minor. It was not countersigned by my father, which I later realized probably made it null and void. But once I turned in chunks of the material, he then told them, you know, about me, and they were fine with it because they saw that I was delivering the goods. And he said, after we got all this together, he said, "So what are you going to do now?" I said, "Well, I've been accepted to NYU for the fall." He said, "I just hired you to write a book." I said, "I know, but I'm supposed to go to college." I mean, I could not think outside that box. And I'm glad I did what I did. I did go to NYU.
Were you writing the book at the time you were in beginning school?
Well, we did the bulk of the work over that summer. I had to hire people to help. He said, "You'll have to hire people to help you. Try to have some money left." Very good advice.
Note to self.
I had a little bit left. I had some left. Thank goodness. But I did
so
have to spend a lot,
so he's giving you
too.
A budget and what you need to spend out of that to hire enough help to get it done is your responsibility, and then what's left is yours.
Correct.
Okay.
So we worked furiously over the summer, and it drifted into the fall. So, yes, I was still working on it while I began my freshman year at NYU. And I learned my most important lesson then about working on what is a reference book, which is check, recheck, and then re-recheck your facts. And the more pairs of eyes that look at what you've done, the better your odds that you'll be accurate. And we do that to this day. There are at least four people who look at every review. Because somebody will say, no, it's not New York City, it's Boston. Oh, right, I forgot. You know, or no, it's not pre-World War II, it's post-World War I, you know, some detail like that. Or there's one guy who's worked with me for years who will look at the cast list and he'll say, "You should really include so-and-so, they're on Game of Thrones right now. People will know that name." Oh, good idea, we add that cast name. So more people, the better. And I learned that early because we made mistakes.
So these books...
So that book came out...
Yes.
...in 1969. I was 18 years old. And when it came out, all I could see were the mistakes and the omissions and the flaws and the shortcomings. I was not really proud of it. I was proud of having done it, but I was... I met a guy who had written a number of books, and he said to me, the only people who don't make mistakes are people who don't do anything. And it's not an excuse, but it's a consolation.
Like permission to try.
Yeah, yeah. And the book sold modestly well.
What was the name of it?
It had a terrible title, because our rival had already taken up the two best titles. The rival used to run a syndicated newspaper service called the TV Key service that supplied newspapers with TV listings, including movie listings. So they had taken the title the TV Key Movie Guide, which would be the same as the TV Movie Guide, mm-hmm. which is what the book was.
Right.
Couldn't use that title. And then he changed his title to Movies on TV, which is the other obvious title for a book of this sort. So we finally struggled and came up with the terrible title, TV Movies. And that's what
it
was
for.
Yeah, it's not the worst, but it was not the best either. But it was what it was called for a number of years. And it was 5 years before I got a call. That editor left Signet. The person who took his place called 5 years later and said, I think it's time to update that book. So it came out for the second time in 1974. And then it was 4 years before we updated it again in 1978. And at that point, the editor said, I think we should do this every other year. So that was the first time we had sort of a guarantee of coming out on a regular basis.
So even years. You come out in
and
even
then,
years.
In the mid-'80s, yet another editor inherited it and said, you know, with home video now, I think you need to be more current. I think we need to put it out every year. So that's when we started doing it as an annual book.
Hot dog.
Yeah.
When did your name go above the title?
Oh, well, I got hired by Entertainment Tonight in the spring of 1982.
Is Entertainment Tonight still a thing for you guys? It was the thing. It was...
You have to understand that when that show went
Deadline
on the air,
Hollywood.
When that show went on the air, it was there was nothing else like it. Again, it's hard to picture this, but there were no rival. There was no Access Hollywood. There was no Inside Edition. There was no Extra. There was no E Channel. There was no TMZ. There was no internet. And when this show started, skeptics said, how are you going to fill a nightly half-hour show about entertainment? And why would anyone want to watch it? And the show did take time for the show to find its footing. And I was hired by the fifth producer on the show during its first season, toward the end of that first season. And about a year later, I got a call, and eventually my wife and I moved out here. I commuted for a year and a half from New York to L.A., eventually, we moved out here, and I got a call one day from my editor in New York, and he said, we just had our sales conference for the coming season, and we'd like to make two changes to the book, if it's okay with you. I said, what? He said, we'd like to put your name above the title and your photo on the cover. I said, it's okay with me. But if I had begged them 1 year earlier to do that, they would have laughed in my face. But now I was on TV. And at the time, Entertainment Tonight was like one of the hottest shows on television. An enormous audience, something like 10 million viewers every night. And I was on it at least three times a week. So it meant something to sell it on the strength of my familiarity from television.
And you were doing film reviews and...
At first, they just hired me to do movie reviews at first, but I started pushing very early on to get to do feature stories and interesting stories of Hollywood history. And eventually they let me start interviewing the people.
Now, we know you're in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yeah.
We know you're on Topps Gum Cards.
Right.
What other, like, really just interesting, bizarre Leonard Maltin facts can these guys call home and tell about?
Don't call home. Well, I was answer to a puzzle on Wheel of Fortune. Vanna White, you know, turned the letters around and it said film critic Leonard Maltin. That's
a good one.
That was fun. There have been odds and ends like that, which are always...
Are those the most fun things? Just those little weird souvenirs?
Well, sure. Sure. Well, I mean, you know, it's just one giant perk, you know. It's a lovely side effect, if you will, you know, or unexpected result of being in the public eye.
I'm really happy to know...
The Sopranos.
You were on The Sopranos?
On an episode of Sopranos, when Tony and Carmela broke up for a while, and they're living separately, Carmela starts a movie club with her friends, and she says, and they're going to watch all the AFI Top 100 movies. And she said, well, let's see what Leonard Maltin said about Citizen Kane. And she takes out my book. That was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. So let's see what Leonard Maltin said. No. It's really good to know that you are fair-handed, and even if somebody is your friend, you will review their film honestly, because in this book that you wrote, 151 Best Movies You've Never Seen, movie number 29 is Disney's Teacher's Pet.
It sure is.
And I always wondered if you just put it in here because you were so nice and we were friends. And now I'm glad to
know. No, I really like that movie
a
lot.
I wasn't hunting for compliments, yes. But I kind of was a little bit. This is a really good book, you guys. No, but I always just kind of wonder, oh, Leonard, he's being such a good friend to us. Nobody saw that movie.
I had a friend of mine who worked in television made his first feature 5 or 6 years ago, and I was petrified. What am I going to do if I don't like it? Because I hadn't had that dilemma in a while.
Yeah, that's nervous.
And I went to see it. I did like it, and it got lousy reviews from almost everybody else, but I swear to you, I liked it.
Did he believe you?
Yes, he did.
Good.
And I had him come to my class, as I had you and Bill come for, with your film. I don't know why other people didn't see in it what I saw in it, but...
Since you mentioned your class, and I want to come back to your college years, but you are now a college professor, and you have been for how...
16 years.
16 years. Leonard teaches a legendary class at USC.
Well, it's legendary because it's been around so long, and it was started in the early 60s by a man who was a very prominent film critic of that period named Arthur Knight, and he had the idea that was original, if not unique, at that time, of screening films and having the filmmakers come for Q&A. And now it's done quite a lot. It's done here. There's almost a circuit.
Yes,
now.
We have script to screen.
Sometimes studios want to promote a film to this age demo of you guys will send a filmmaker out on the road for weeks, just going to campus screenings. But at this time, no one else was doing that. He had the idea. And he taught it for a good many years. George Lucas took that class.
As a student?
As a student. Ron Howard took that class as a student. It has a long, long history. When he retired, Charles Chaplin, who was then the very well-regarded film critic for the L.A. Times, taught it for a good number of years also. And then I'm the latest one to inherit this class. And I've been doing it for 16 years.
So you've had it for 16 years. What is it that you wish to impart to your students that you can impart to us today about film?
Well, one of the first things I say at the beginning of every semester is I want to make you a smarter audience. That's my goal. Because the studios think you're dumb. They really do. And they don't think that there's an audience for smart films. They really don't. And it's gotten worse now that they're selling their films more to, you know, the world market than they are to the home market here in the U.S. I mean, if you settle for what they're pumping out week after week, all we're going to get are films like Battleship. You know, and that's a dreadful idea to have more of those. And I've shown my class, like this class, my class is made up from all parts of the campus. It's not just film majors. So it's a real audience. It's a genuine 20-something audience. And I've shown them foreign language films, and most of them don't... How many of you don't like to see foreign language films? Or don't go to see foreign language films? You don't like reading subtitles? And don't be embarrassed. It's not... It's okay. It's really okay. There are a lot of people who would rather have dental surgery than read subtitles. But I've shown some great foreign language films in my class, and they've loved them. They surprise themselves. They surprise themselves. Whoa, this is really good. You get past the barrier of the subtitles if you're involved in the film, and the story, and the acting, and the presentation. So that's one thing. Another thing is a lesson I learned the very first night I taught. I told you the format. We show films just before they open theatrically, and we have a guest or several guests from the film. I started teaching in January of 1998. And they said, we'll book the films, don't worry. We'll book the guests. Turns out I get involved in the booking, but they do the heavy lifting. And I said, what's our opening film? Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. Oh, great. Terrific. Can we get Quentin to come? No, he's going to be in London for the premiere there. Oh, it's too bad. Well, can we get... I started rattling off. No, they're all going to be in London for the premiere. I said, well, who are we getting? They said, the sound mixer. I said, we've got Quentin Tarantino's first film in 5 years, and our guest is the sound mixer? Really? That's the best we could do? So I watched the film again that night. I'd seen it, but I watched it again that night with a heightened awareness of sound. Listening for, what have they done with the sound of this movie? And let me tell you, it was really interesting.
Hmm.
It was really interesting. He shot a lot of it at the Del Amo Mall where he used to hang out as he was growing up. How do you get natural sound at a noisy place like a mall? How do you do that? There's a scene where somebody gets whacked inside a panel truck. How do you create the sound of a bullet, going off inside a truck? Things like that. It's like I had questions to ask. Then it turned out that it wasn't just some sound mixer. It's a 3-time Oscar-winning sound mixer who's a third-generation sound man in Hollywood. Great guy named Michael Minkler, who I've had back several times since then. He was really interesting. And the lesson I learned a multifaceted lesson. I learned, don't be a smartass. Everybody contributes to the film. But what I really learned was that everybody contributes creatively to the film. And people who think of someone like a sound mixer as a technician, they're all wrong. If he's a technician, that film isn't going to be very good. If he doesn't understand what the meaning is of every scene, what's being emphasized, what should be underscored, what has to be pushed or subdued, he is not giving Quentin Tarantino what he needs to make that scene as effective as it can be. So he's got to be an artist. He is a creative contributor to the movie. So is everybody else. Some more, perhaps more creative than others, some more glamorous than others. But I've never been snarky or snide about anybody's contribution since that night.
Talking about watching films smartly, what are some of the ways that you tell your students, that you help your students learn to watch films more intelligently?
Oh, well, I don't... They're broad things. I mean, I look for originality. And I don't have a checklist of demands for a movie. And I think what I try to do is I try to take each movie on its own terms. So if you're going to see a slasher movie, you're not expecting King Lear.
And vice versa. A little bit of slasher.
And vice versa. Well, that's true. and vice versa. I mean, I think you take each film for what it's trying to be and what it's supposed to be, not for what it isn't. And does it succeed at what it sets out to do?
Has it done what it came to do?
As it does what it came to do. And so that's how I try to, receive or ingest a movie with that in mind.
Sorry to put you on the spot, but what are some of the films for you that stand out in your mind? There's ones we've never seen, but films that did what they came to do that you would recommend to these guys for weekend Netflix enjoyment?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I don't know where to begin. A film I used for years as my sort of go-to recommendation movie is David Mamet's House of Games. David Mamet, the great American playwright, has made a handful of movies as writer and director, and I think this was his first. And he uses some of the same actors he likes from his stage work, including Joe Mantegna, who wasn't really known when he made this movie.
Our former neighbor.
From the 80s. It's so good. I saw it not that many years ago. I revisited it. It's just a really good, clever, twisty, mind game thriller. Very low key, but awfully, awfully good. You know, every year there are films that come out that people don't see. I think you missed it. How many people saw Mud last year? Both of you. more than two. Okay. Mud is my favorite movie of 2013. And it actually did fairly well for an independent movie. But financially, I mean. But these films are very hard to sell to an audience because they don't have the money to buy big billboard ads and bus ads. They sometimes don't have... This did have stars in it, but it came out before the reconnaissance. This was the beginning of the reconnaissance. It really was.
Have you coined this term, reconnaissance?
No.
I really like it.
No, that's third hand.
Okay. Well appropriated.
Let me tell you, last spring when the movie came out, and I started touting it to everyone who would listen to me, and some people who wouldn't listen to me, too. I said, you got to see this movie called Mud. It's a new film by Jeff Nichols, really talented writer-director. And he says he was inspired by Mark Twain. You don't hear that very often these days. And he's from Arkansas, and he filmed it where he grew up. And it's just a wonderful, original, compelling film. Hard to describe, actually. It's about two boys, two 12-year-old boys, who have a kind of an adventure. They find this drifter guy and decide to help him with this crazy scheme he's got in his head. The drifter is played by Matthew McConaughey. And when I was telling people about the film, they would always say, and it's the only thing anybody ever asks, who's in it? I said, well, it's really about these two boys, but Matthew McConaughey plays the drifter. And people would go, oh.
Pre-reconnaissance.
Yeah. Pre-reconnaissance. Oh. And it turned them off to seeing the movie. I said, no, he's really good. Trust me, he's really good in this film. And he was. And it was if that film were to be released today...
A whole different story.
It might have more street cred and it might attract a bigger audience. But even at the very best... And Reese Witherspoon is in it too, and Sam Shepard, and there's a lot of good people in it, but...
Trying to see if it's on Netflix.
By now, it's everywhere.
It is?
It's everywhere.
Okay, we're going to make this an extra credit opportunity.
And I don't know Matthew McConaughey, but I saw him at a function during the award season. I sort of planted myself in his path and introduced myself, and I said, no disrespect to the Dallas Buyers Club, which I loved, but I just was crazy about Mud and loved your performance in it. He said, Mud is the best movie I've ever made. So he thinks
the reconnaissance man said this.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And Jeff Nichols came to my class, and he's a very impressive guy, and I think he's going to have a great career, a long career.
So I just want to pause for one sec because I want to tell you, I know it's late in the quarter, and we're looking for extra credit opportunities. So if you watch Mud or House of Cards.
House of Games.
Sorry, House of Games. Not House of Cards.
House of Cards is good, too.
They're
but
both
this is
on
House
Netflix.
Games, right?
But go for the right one. Watch House of Games, David Mamet's House of Games, or Mud. Write up those two pages of smart movie viewing. Take into account the sound, the props. Listen to what we've heard today and report on that, and we'll count that as an extra credit opportunity for you. Okay? Mm-hmm. Questions? More questions? Yes?
So far, what has been your
favorite movie of 2014 to date?
The Grand Budapest Hotel. Wes Anderson's film.
Hear a lot of agreement.
I'm glad. And you know what else I loved? I loved Captain America, the Winter Soldier. It's stupendously good. And I think one of the best comic book superhero movies ever made. No, I thought the first one was half of a good movie. The first half was really good, and then it sort of, for me, it petered out. And this one, just everything clicked.
It did what it came to do.
It did. It exceeded what it came to
do. Oh.
Truly.
Okay. I haven't seen it. Billy went without
me. I'm not kidding.
You know what? I didn't go because I didn't like the first one.
This one's a different story. It really is a different story.
Okay. Yes. Youth, and then yes. We'll start with you. Do you have a favorite genre?
When I was growing up, it was comedy. In fact, I didn't want to see anything serious when I was young. But then comedy changed. And now when you say comedy, it means, you know, this brand of raunchy, you know, comedy that I've had to sort of make my peace with. But again, there's good raunchy comedies and bad raunchy comedies. I mean, Judd Apatow makes smart comedies that happen to be raunchy. I don't love all of them, but, I mean, he's a really, really bright guy.
What would be an example of one that you do love?
The Hangover is a really funny movie.
Okay.
Really, really funny. And I'm sorry that they went back to the well twice. They made a lot of money. They made a fortune of money, so that makes them geniuses. But those movies sucked. They're an insult to the audience. They stole our money. But the first one's a really funny movie. You know, and Apatow's best movies, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really, really good movies.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I used to say comedy, but now I feel like I have to qualify it.
And early comedies, if you were going to send us back to one of your favorite comedies in the Netflix well?
Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times.
Okay.
If you haven't seen Modern Times with Charlie Chaplin, your life is poorer as a result.
This is, for many reasons, an historic occasion. Thank you so much. We'll stick around a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.